assignment list in a bit. I have yet to get a copy of the second edition for myself. They ran out of it before I got there. But everybody has everything that you need.
Yeah, I just have a question. It's just an idea, just from that request. Is there any way, I don't know how often to use it, we can open up a discussion forum on the discussion board?
Absolutely. Sure.
All I have to do is enable it, and then we can post a thread if we wanted to discuss amongst
ourselves. Yeah, don't you dare ask. Yeah, I'll do that. I'll try to do that this evening.
Yes.
Let's see. Okay. There was one thing.
Which means we know.
I mentioned that the November 26th class will be entirely online. We're working on, I'm still waiting for a hosting service to become available so I can put the full videos of the lectures on. When this does happen, I'll put everything that we've done to date. At this point, I did put the audio from last time in two parts on Blackboard. If you want to review anything or if you missed the lecture last night.
Ça marche.
Ça marche.
Bon, ben allez.
Ok, so...
Bon, je me sauve.
Oh, bon.
Je te verrai aux vidéos.
Très bien.
Hein?
Très bien. Très bien. And this thing here, very good.
Yeah.
And let's make this up. The increased reading capability. Righty. Okay. Welcome to this evening. I'm Nicholas Spencer, thinking century theologian, diplomat, ecclesiastic, state churchman, mystic, philosopher, and various other things. Of course, the question that may be running through your mind is, why this fellow?
Why?
Why Nicholas Spencer?
Well, partly because
one reason is this.
I think he's really neat.
And when else would you get to talk about him? Theoretically, you could talk about him in the medieval world, or in some course on medieval something or other. And that would be perfectly appropriate, because he has, well, in many cases, and certainly in his, it's hard to sometimes to say whether a person belongs more to the Middle Ages or to the Renaissance. In any case, when I taught medieval world, which I used to do, I concentrated on the 12th century, which meant there were a lot of interesting people in the later Middle Ages that you had to leave out, such as Nicholas. And so, I didn't know the way to do it in the Renaissance world. At any rate, Nicholas, a lot of people find Nicholas very interesting, particularly philosophical types, I must admit. And interesting as well as an attractive figure. And this has gone on, I guess you could say, yes, there are major thinkers who have been interested in him and have continued to be interested in him up through the 20th century. And if the 20th century is any indication, then probably into... I'm sort of out of the view, aren't I?
Yeah.
Well, that's okay. If the 20th century is indication, then any indication, then probably people will continue to be interested in him in the 21st century. At any rate, yes, he's a very interesting figure. It certainly won't hurt anybody to know about him. I think that for our purposes, for your purposes in this course, there are certain ways in which he's another light, I suppose, thrown on this question of Renaissance humanism. Although, once again, in some ways he belongs to that movement and in some ways not. One of the questions that I asked you to think about was, is Nicholas of Cusa a humanist? And, of course, this is a question that it does not have an answer in the sense of there's no right or wrong or true or false about this. It's a heuristic device for helping you to think about the different aspects of him, the different aspects of Renaissance humanism, and so forth. So, in some ways he is like that, some ways he isn't. What could we say about that? What would you say about that? insofar as you're beginning to get a handle on, or do have a handle on, what Renaissance humanism is. Which, of course, is a multivariate thing, and not just one thing, but different things in different people. Any thoughts about that? I hope you have thoughts. Yes, ma'am.
Well, he uses the dialogue approach.
Sorry? Yes, go ahead.
He uses the dialogue approach.
Now that's very true. Of course, this goes both ways.
Yeah.
Oh, you're talking about here, yes, in our text here, we have a dialogue. That is for sure. And that is very popular with the Renaissance humanists, many of them, although it's not something that is unknown in the medieval period. And in particular, there are various people who would have done dialogues on subjects like this one, of disputes among people of different worldviews. And in particular, well, the question of religion. Abelard has one that involves a Jew, a Greek, meaning in his case just a philosopher, and I guess a Western Christian guy. Often they are in form fairly ironic, or in their way of treating each other, that is to say, they don't insult each other and so forth.
Yeah.
But, nevertheless, yes, but that point, your point is a good one, I think. Yes, ma'am? Okay, and in what regard is this, what would you relate to?
Understanding
humans. Yeah. Yes, yes, I would agree with that. I mean, that seems to me a good point. Yes, ma'am? There's a respect for the other person, a respect of diversity, we would say, in modern terms, or 15th century terms, too. Yes, yes. And that is characteristic of some Renaissance humanists. I think you no doubt talked about, with regard to Petrarch, how he is at the outset of this beginning of a new kind of historical consciousness. That is to say, an awareness of the fact that we're different from the people in the past. Initially, this is understood or experienced in a negative way. That is to say, we've traveled far, far too far away from what people were in the good old days of classical civilization and early Christianity. Both are important for Petrarch. But so that's my point. Well, that historical diversity, chronological diversity, that understanding also can manifest itself, or eventually will, horizontal, is that what I want to say? A horizontal or a synchronous or geographical diversity. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Well, as far as humanism, not only recognition of the past, but also recognition of other civilizations.
Yeah,
the humanists recognize yourself within your civilization, and since there weren't any nation states per se at the time, that was your first and foremost reference to see yourself as a human being within the culture and civilization, apart from the laws.
And your civilization being Western
Western. Because he's talking dialogue with the Hindus.
He is.
As opposed to the medievals, you have Aquinas or Dante. They're facing their arguments directly towards the Islamic faith. But just that, they're not really seeing it.
By and large, that's true. And by and large, they're not, I suppose, seeing people in their rootedness in their own cultures and traditions and so forth quite to the same extent as this. Maybe I've been making stuff. Now, as to this issue of nation states, this is a period when nation states are having an increasing importance.
But as far as the foundation, it's more so the fact that your understanding of humanity, first and foremost, encompasses
that's probably true.
Eventually, it refines more towards geographical and local customs. And eventually, you have some type of boundaries and governments formed to maintain that.
Of course, it is interesting in this context that in the dialogue, he has not only people from, well, Scythia, Tartars, and Indians, and so forth, and Persian, but he has different kinds of Europeans. So there's the Italian, well, there's the Greek, whatever that is. Sorry, there's German. I don't know. Is there an Englishman?
Yeah,
I think there is. And there's a Bohemian, isn't there?
Is that right?
Or no?
Yeah.
There's a Bohemian, and so Spanish. There's an awareness of some kind of particularities. Although, by and large, that those names, those identifications, don't translate to anything very concrete. And you know, differences between the different characters. Very good. Other things that are on your mind about this, other ways in which he is or is not like what are you beginning to associate with Renaissance humanism? Yes, ma'am. You're saying this is a non-humanistic aspect?
Well, I thought it was more the human idea that kind of worked its way into the humanity has been up to the Renaissance being the secularization of, but the humanists come in and they say, no, there is God and faith and there are these moral standards.
Oh, yes. Yes. It is certainly a very, very blinkered or narrow understanding of Renaissance humanism. Say that it is unreligious or anti-religious.
Right.
I certainly agree with you there. I don't know that belief in one God is not something that would distinguish the Renaissance humanists from people in the Middle Ages, insofar as what.
Okay. In comparison to medieval times.
Yes. That is to say, insofar as that is one aspect of some of these writers and others in what we call the Renaissance, that they are very conscious of themselves as being unhappy with the institutions, educational among others, such as they have come down to their day and have been formed by what was going on in what we now call the Middle Ages. And they say this is far from what is ideal. The content of this education and the form, the manner in which it's delivered, is not really well adapted to human beings. And therefore, we want to hark back to something that we think is better. We think of it as a return to something that is better adapted to human beings, and consequently it's a rejection of what has come before. Not in all respects of what has come before, but in certainly important. Now, this question, yes, sir.
And also, I've seen at one point uses can be a philological approach, and especially when breaking down the Quran, that's when he analyzes it, critiques it.
Okay, and you're associating this
like,
with.
Well, humanists use a lot of historical criticism and analyzing the times with the philological approach.
There is. That is true. And
I
there
see
are
a
some
bit
ways.
Of that too.
Yes, that he does have that side to him. This again is one of the things that cuts both ways, since he is not the first person, although there weren't so very many of them, but there was a tradition, at least in the high Middle Ages, of intellectuals, Christian intellectuals, studying the Quran and studying Islam. And so this goes back to particularly Peter the Great, or Peter the Venerable, Peter the Great is Russian. Peter the Venerable in the 12th century. Has somebody translate the Quran for him. He's a monk. And he's abbot of Cluny. And does some kind of a study or a reaction commentary on it and so forth. And certainly Thomas and people in his day are well aware of it and respond to it. And so, in a sense, you could say, oh, well, this is a certain kind of medieval tradition that he's following through on. On the other hand, certainly in other places, you'll see that he is interested, or he has a little bit more awareness of linguistic matters and stylistic matters than, and there are some subtle things that he has to say about interpretation of the Quran and so forth. But yeah, okay, good. Anything else? What has been coming to the fore in your discussion so far? Important aspects of Renaissance humanism. Again, understanding that it's a multifarious thing. But what have we mentioned so far? Well, diversity, awareness of diversity, and cultural diversity, other kinds. Interesting linguistic, stylistic matters. What else have we said? Yes, sir.
Clash of civilization.
Yes, although there are two, that's part of the world situation. You could say that that's one of the ways in which Renaissance carries through things from the medieval period as well. But they're certainly aware in certain ways of clash of civilizations or potential clash of civilizations. The Crusades start in the 11th century and go on from there. So, all right. Yes? No.
Yes, and here's the way that you just perhaps say something about it. It's not in this light, in this light, even though it's large, it's not.
Well, that's okay. Well, but that's an important question. And that may be one of the areas in which you say, well, it's more like a deal. Yeah. Yes. It's not something, as far as I know, Nicholas, that jumps out from Nicholas. Now, he is concerned, like any thoughtful person in the 15th century, whether he's, you know, of humanistic inclinations or not, in some kind of reform. And particularly, given his position in church reform, all kinds of problems with the church. We got to do something about it. He doesn't speak of it in terms of, we got to go back to the way things were in the first century, or the second century, or whatever it is. And in other regards, he's not someone who says, oh, we must follow Augustine and nobody else. We must worship at his temple or something. And we must also, what else? Other things about certain classical authors as masters of style. That's not present in him at all. In fact, you can probably tell this from the English, but it's certainly true in the Latin that he's was equally true. He's not a great stylist. His syntax, for the most part, is clear, which I appreciate. But he goes in for these weird neologisms and twisty, strange ways of using terms, and some real what you have to call either not barbarism, solecisms. Strange things that he does in certain words. And generally speaking, he doesn't sound interested at all in the stylistic signs and elegances of the Latin language at all. Now, we do know that he was undoubtedly... Yeah, we're going to look at some of these things. Well, yeah, we'll look at these various things I have available for. He's certainly aware of he comes a century after Petrarch, just about exactly a century, and he undoubtedly knows that, you know, people are real interested in manuscripts these days. He doesn't seem to talk very much about Greek manuscripts or Greek authors reading the original. I should think he has some acquaintance with Greek, because he spent time on, he was a diplomat, he had to go over to Constantinople, and he was hobnobbed with these Greek fellows at the Council of Florence, and so forth. So, strange if he didn't pick up some. but he doesn't speak about it. He mentions the odd Greek word here and there. But he does, at one point, he does bring a manuscript of the plays of Plautus, the Latin playwright, to Rome from Tyre, I think. Who he brings it to, I don't know, but it's obviously someone is interested in having this, and he realized it was important to provide it as a manuscript witness to this more or less classical or early Latin writer. So there's a sort of a tangential connection there with that particular kind of humanist interest in old manuscripts. Right. Okay. Anything else? Yes, ma'am. This is that could be a significant thing, or certainly one can interpret it that way. He does seem to be not that that's completely absent in the earlier centuries of the Middle Ages, but he seems to be particularly confident about human abilities. Now, there are certain ways in which humans sometimes are going to drive human beings' horns, as it were, and teach them a lesson. But there are other ways in which they are extremely, enthusiastic and buoyant and hopeful for the future, and thinking we can change things, we can improve things, and so forth. And there is, of course, incredible optimism in this text. Not to say, of course, as some of the modern writers said, do not expect from a vision in the dream more than what a vision in the dream can give. That's what he said. And the details have to be worked out. Now, at the very top level, you sort of have the Council of Florence. They came to an agreement which, fell apart when they tried to get rid of it. But he couldn't have been as naive, especially since he had been studying climate here in a political ideological capacity. And I knew very well the kinds of opposition and problems he run into. So this is kind of a, it's sort of like a distant goal, a beacon or something that he's perhaps providing. Or something that he thinks is fundamentally true, even if people are not aware of it and it's not brought out manifest in very, very concrete ways, it's still something that's there. In any case, yes, I think that's something I would agree with, that he's almost impossibly hopeful about it, so it seems. This particular problem, and then more generally in his understanding of human nature and the spiritual life, the spiritual progress, or coming to understand the divine, well, he thinks he can do it. It's you have to concentrate, you have to twist your mind into shapes and things normally, but you can do it, and you kind of need to do it, and so there you are. In this, he is perhaps like his distant predecessor, Plotinus, 4th century, are we talking, I think, who also, he develops first this idea of the, amongst pagan philosophy, this idea of this ascent of the mind through various levels up to the highest. He, too, is kind of an optimist. Way of saying you can do it. You can do it if you try. and so that's of a piece. He's like that in all of his writings. So yesterday I was curious to the Latin the ease with which people agree is
they are. It could be just as if the Council of Florence, you know, you had these Byzantine theologians and psychiatrists who felt like they had to go along with this idea of the human being as the present of Christianity. Because that's what the emperor really wanted. And so here, you're in the heavenly court, and it's pretty clear what God wants. So, I don't know, I don't know the answer to that question. Is he as naive as he seems? Does he know very much all about these religions? Other than the ones he clearly knows most about, and still doesn't talk about very much, is Islam, and theoretically Judaism. But not terribly, it doesn't seem, it doesn't show that he knows it profoundly. Otherwise, for these more Eastern religions, his main source seems to be, or an important one, is Marco Polo, whose text he read and annotated. And so it's probably fairly superficial, if you like, and concrete, you know, not at all. So, about all he has to say about what Indian religion is, they worship a lot of idols. yes, and in a certain sense, of course, if he did know anything about their Hindu or Buddhist philosophy, I think that would encourage for the ones that he has, that to say that these are manifestations at a certain level, but at a higher level, religion is something more. A little bit more in harmony regarding that. And so, what are you doing here? Yes. So, if you like, or even if you don't, but this is what I had in mind. I have a list of my own things, which is like a convention. Yes, you want to say it.
The fact that it may be outside of time is why it's so optimistic.
I would go along. That seems like a good idea to me.
Because it seems it's kind of like you read Daniel about the vision of the man in the mountain that covered the whole earth. It's like there is heaven talking about this. It's not necessarily like, well, you know, by the end of Pope Nicholas V's reign, this will all be done. It's something that this is what God wants. It doesn't mean it's going to happen.
That's why, yes, why in connection to that, what we were saying earlier about the fact that it's this optimism may not be due to an ignorance of the difficulties of concrete situations and disagreements, but rather he's thinking what is most deeply true in people's experience, even though in the concrete it seems very diverse and in fact opposed. As in all cases, I mean, when he talks about, in other regards, when he talks about religious philosophy or mysticism, if you want to call that the spiritual quest, understanding God, he says that what we're aiming at, of course, is a learned ignorance, that is to say, exactly the right kind of ignorance. And we have to somehow project our minds beyond a wall, and on the other side of that wall is God, who is completely inconceivable. Completely inconceivable. Nevertheless, that's where we have to try and protect ourselves in a way. And this is a subset or an example of this doing that in a way. Yes, this is the fundamental unity of religion, of our diverse religious experience, if you can project beyond the variations and diversity that you see in the sense world and the physical world. Yeah, yeah. Anyway, okay, well, I'll run through some ways in which he's not a humanist. These are not in any particular order. One, he's not a rhetorician, and rhetoric, of course, is the god of many people, particularly the Florentine humanists, especially the 15th century. Have you talked about rhetoric? And its importance in the in the Italian Renaissance. It's a colleague, a former colleague, he's retired now, had a
what did he say?
Rhetoric is the new paradigm for all kinds of thought. Rhetoric is the basis for the reform that is going to shape up the church and shape up human society. Rhetoric meaning effective communication between human beings. Whereas an idea that I call from Marie-Dominique Chenu, I think it's his book on the 12th century Renaissance, medieval Renaissance. There are, there are a couple, two or three Renaissances before you get to the Italian Renaissance. Have you talked about this? Have you ever talked about this? It's a useful way of organizing it, I think. A Renaissance in the context of Western history, cultural history, is a renewal of cultural activity, I guess, of thought, of art, and so forth, by means of, or in association with, a renewed contact with the, shall we say, the monuments of classical civilization. By classical civilization, I mean Greek or Roman. And so that means their writing, but it can also mean, of course, their architecture, their art, all aspects of this, their philosophy, their legal system, and so on and so forth. Now, the medieval West is never completely out of contact, or never out of contact with that. Nevertheless, there are, there are problems, this thing we refer to as the fall of Rome and the empire, the dissolution of the empire, and barbarian invasions, and the rise of feudalism, and so on and so forth. Nevertheless, there were certain points in which there is an attempt to, what shall I say, it's thought, it's believed that in order to get our society, Christian, and of its various components, ethnological and so forth, to get it on its feet again, we really, really need what classical civilization has to offer. And so they collect together as much knowledge about it as they can and attempt to improve their understanding of it and their use of it. So the first time this happens is, associate this with the 9th century, beginning around 800, Charlemagne. Of course, knowledge of classical culture had persisted, particularly thanks, of course, to the work of the monks and transcribing things and so forth. At any rate, this is a big concerted effort to do what I'm talking about. He's very, very concerned about education. Education is primarily education of clergy. The clergy that Charlemagne is planning to use not only to reform and improve the church, but also to provide people who can read and write, or administration of his empire. Now, unfortunately, as you may know, later on in the 9th century and on into the 10th century, what do you have happening? Two problems. One problem is more barbarian invasions, particularly the Norse, although there are others happening elsewhere as well, because there's Islamic business coming from the south and the east and so forth. Anyway, but mainly that. And the other problem is the fact that they have not quite caught on to this idea or the usefulness of primogeniture, which is to say, only one person inherits the bulk of the territory. And so you have the empire splitting up into two or three with his grandchildren, and then perhaps into smaller units, at least practically speaking, after that, and so forth. So this attempt at renewal of the society through a renewed contact with the works of antiquity was put on hold, shall we say. Although it certainly had an impact that was not lost later on. 11th century, 12th century, shall we say, things are cooling off. And we're also having, a number of things happening. Population increasing, agriculture is doing better. In certain ways, there's less fighting, at least from as a result of people coming from outside the civilization. And with that comes this really, if you like, it's an attempt to let's go back. I don't know if they said it this way, but we're going to go back to this project that Charlemagne take up where they left off. And this is particularly what you associate with the 12th century, the so-called 12th century Renaissance. Now, 13th century, so there's renewed interest in classical Latin texts in particular that were not unknown, but were not studied as intensively and such by so many people as became true of the 12th century. 13th century, end of the 12th and on into the 13th century, some new texts are coming, particularly of Aristotle. And you have another kind or another phase of this medieval Renaissance. Now, you've heard of this thing called the liberal arts, which are, you know, the studio humanitatis are sort of associated with it, but it's a different grouping, it's a different list of disciplines that you have in the studio humanitatis. But in the liberal arts, which is a late antique notion inherited by the Middle Ages, you have seven in all. You have three and four. Three, which are the language arts, or the language of, or the arts and science, and four, which are the real world, or how should I say, they're the study of nature itself. Of the structure of nature, which turns out to be mainly mathematical. And these are called the trivium, not because they're trivial, but because they're three. Or it's three ways, probably. Although our word of trivial may come from this, that people are making fun of this medieval stuff, and it's all a lot of nonsense. Okay. And the quadrivium. Okay. Especially for these, since so much of this, not all of it, but particularly in the medieval period, the real emphasis or the real influence is classical texts, written texts. It is the language arts that typify these different renaissances. However, the emphasis in the 9th century is on grammar. Grammar understood not only as a study of rules of right language, but of interpretation of texts, understanding texts. That's grammar. Knowledge of texts, of great texts. 12th century Renaissance is a continuation of that with some different emphases, of course, different character in some regard, but it's taking that up again. The shift, largely because of this influx of new texts that hadn't been known before by Aristotle, is a shift to, what are the trivial arts? There's grammar.
Rhetoric.
Well, there's one in between them. What is it?
Logic,
or sometimes dialectic, they say. Okay. So this is rules of writing, rules of thinking, rules of
speaking,
communicating with other people, I suppose. But not just rules. Okay. So emphasis in the 12th is still grammar, but in the 13th, you'd say, is logic or dialectic. Now, what characterizes and distinguishes the 14th or 14th, 15th, the Italian Renaissance, initially Italian, is insisting now on rhetoric. And rhetoric, understood particularly in this way that I said, is it's not just, you know, speaking well, but being able to speak and so forth, having effective speeches, being able to communicate with other people, being able to persuade them, talk effectively with them about the best way to order society. And this is a new model for, in a sense, for everything, because rhetoric, yes, I think you'd say certainly 12th century, people are starting to understand even theology in grammatical terms. Grammatical and to a certain extent logical terms. That's how they're trying to develop theological ideas. Certainly the 13th century, ooh, yes. Oh, reason, oh, the rules of reasoning.
are what you apply to the data of Revelation or the data of Scripture. Okay, this is a markedly new emphasis that you have with this new phase of the Renaissance. If you want to, you can look at it that way. This is all part of one Renaissance. Okay, so all right, back to my list of non-humanist features of our hero, tonight's hero. He doesn't seem very interested in that aspect, perhaps a superficial blend of rhetoric, which is speaking well and speaking like, I don't know, Cicero would or Augustine would. Okay. Second thing, and again, these are in no special order, he's interested in what's on the other side of the wall, not so much on what's on this side of the wall. The wall being this wall, what's the easiest names for it? He does speak about this wall sometimes. You know, which is utterly, what is beyond that is utterly beyond our experience and utterly beyond our conception. Well, okay, that doesn't go along so well with what is true of some of the humanists, certainly, and our 15th century people in Florence, it's certainly true that they have a new interest in the world we live in, as much or more so than the world to come. And the world of human experience and human exchanges, human society, the horizontal rather than the vertical of the highest reality, which is very unlike the one that we're immersed in. Okay, a third point. of course, a lot of these seems to be used both ways. He's too sure of himself. too sure of his method of reaching the absolute truth. Whereas, as we'll see, skepticism is one aspect of, is an important aspect of Renaissance humanism, not of all of them, but of many. Another point, doesn't seem to be especially interested in reading texts in Greek, so he's unlike a lot of the 15th century Florentine people. Here's another point. He's too much of an old style theologian, very abstract. whereas if you look at Petrarch, it's very personal and concrete in certain ways. And if you look at Erasmus, they're very, in certain ways, very down to earth, very human, and not on these heights heights that you can't even imagine and so forth. Okay. Another point. He's too much in the line of medieval mysticism and the Neoplatonic tradition. This is something that goes through all these people in the, goodness gracious, the 9th century, the 5th century, 9th century, 11th century, 12th century, 13th century. It's the same old stuff over again. Now, of course, we'll come back to this and see why this is inadequate to say simply this, but let's talk about Neoplatonism. Is that all right? Is that okay? you gotta love it, you gotta hate it. You gotta deal with it. Neoplatonism, when does it start? Who starts it? That's a good name. That's a good name. He's not number one. He's not the first, though. Who do we associate it with, particularly? Do you know? I'll give you a... Somebody said it. Otherwise, I would give you, letters. Until you find me recognize, yes. Plotinus, I think we're talking 4th century A.D. Greek writer, although he spent some time in the novel. I'm not sure. Plotinus. And the idea is, now I'm speaking very superficially, someone I've read little bits of them and so forth, but I'm no authority on this. In any case, what did Plotinus do? He organized certain Platonic concepts into a new system that would have a long afterlife. And particularly this idea of, well, you could say, first, or one aspect is the ideas of and the things that you see manifested in the world that you know, but behind them there is a more intellectual
universal quality in another realm, as it were, that explains the fact that these are these exist on one hand and are not yet a complete embodiment of the quality of the mind. There's more and less and so forth. And you get the idea, well, there's got to be some supreme notion of it. So the idea is, along with that, the idea of participation. There's varying degrees of all of them in what we see manifested vision, degrees of participation in these ideas. You're going to say, sir? And I hope you don't ask too much, because I'm not qualified to say too much. Anyway, just the most broadest, and not to say superficial, notions here. Okay, the ideas is one thing. And then in one text, the Timaeus, one dialogue, he does have this notion of apparently of some kind of a god, and then a creative under god called the Demiurge. And the Demiurge is responsible for making the world that we know, because there's a higher god beyond that. Okay, so and this and whatever else things I don't know, and of course there's this also this period or line of thinkers before Plotinus called Middle Platonism, contributed, no doubt. Anyway, he has this notion of three. What do we call them? Are they hypostases? There is when we're talking about the nature of the world, including not only the world of physical manifestation that we know, but at the higher reaches that we believe to exist. The very, very highest is what he calls the One, and this is what we would think of as God, but it is beyond. It is so far beyond, that it's beyond being. And you think, oh, well, especially if you're, have some kind of mystic trait. Oh, God is being. No, it's beyond being. Particularly this makes sense if you think of being as something that you associate with things that you know. Being individual beings in this world, it's a sensual world. If that's what being is, if these things are being, God is not that. One is not that. He's beyond being. Then there's this thing called, I think this is Tohen or something like that. Tohen, one. It's neuter. In mind, the Greek nous, which is, what is that? Something like that. Mind. Mind is an emanation or something from the having. And the function of nous seems to be to contemplate the one. It's a kind of an understanding of the one, and is a step down from the unity and the beyondness and the perfection of the one. It's a contemplation of it. Nevertheless, the mind is in very, very close rapport, shall we say, with the one. Then there's a thing that somehow emanates, and I don't know all the details, or if I ever knew them, I've forgotten them. Soul, or psyche, psyche. There's another step down, and is the intermediary between these higher levels and the world that we know, the physical world. And it's also we're getting farther away from the unity and the perfection of this thing with each step that we go down, and it's even worse when we get into the great world. Now, Plotinus is not necessarily, he's not like a, what do you call him, a Manichaean. I don't mean that. He's not like the Manichaean in saying that the created world, or the physical world in which we live, the material world, is evil. He doesn't say that. In fact, he thinks it's basically good. Nevertheless, there is this phenomenon of kind of outgoing from the one into the multiplicity and the more or lessness and the deficiency of participation in, the lack of fullness of participation in whatever is there in one. Okay. Now, I think that I may get confused as to whether this is in Plotinus or in the later Christian tradition of developing of these ideas. I think that the Plato's ideas he puts in the mind, and that's already a kind of a diversification or a division of the unity of the one. And the soul may have something to do with them taking some of these things and manifesting them on these lower material levels. Is that right? Yeah. Great, great. Somebody here knows. Good. Okay. anyway, it's not, he's not negative about creating trouble. But the thing that a human being wants to do, how many people are going to get around to this, I don't know, is in fact, you want, what's the driving, a driving force for the Neoplatonism, for this Neoplatonism, everything wants to human beings, generally, in all periods, is, one could say, is unity. That's one of the things we're after. Or you could say integration, psychological term, I guess, of psychology. That is to say, well, there's this and there's that, there's up and there's down, there's hot and there's cold. Sometimes you're feeling great, sometimes you're feeling lousy. And it's just a terrible thing, this round, all constant changes. And you'd like some still point in all this. You'd like something you can hang on to. Or, yeah, something you can unify all of our experiences and make sense of it. And it seems to me that in a sense, that's a very, very human thing. And one tradition that comes out of that is a tradition of mysticism, various kinds of mysticism, where the thing is to sort of make a breakthrough in consciousness, where you have an experience of unity that has a kind of a decisive effect or a permanent effect on your life. Anyway, so we see that here, and that's, this is an early manifestation of it, although you could say, well, earlier ones, you know, in the subcontinent, but okay. At any rate, this idea of, yes, you can unify yourself and get up to there. As I was saying earlier, he's very optimistic, at least as far as he is concerned, and he thinks other people are able to do this as well. Now, this is 4th century already, I think I'm right about that. What are his dates?
I don't have them right now.
No?
Oh, he's 3rd century, I take it back.
I'm so sorry. Okay. at any rate, Christianity has been around for a while. His notions of his are to be enthusiastically adopted by Augustine, late 4th century. And so one path for a Neoplatonic thought to come down in the West is, okay, we got Plotinus, is through, well, there's Porphyry, but we don't need to worry about him too much, Augustine. Now, of course, Augustine is going to interpret these in very Christian ways, or use them in a Christian context. It is possible that Plotinus himself, who knows, he could have had some influence coming from Christianity, although there's no evidence of that, I think, I guess. But there are other people, Greek philosophers, influenced by Plotinus, who elaborate his thought in the context of pagan, if you like, philosophy, of Greek philosophy, non-Christian philosophy. And that probably, we now probably are talking, I don't remember this guy's date off either right offhand. In particular, one of them is going to be Proclus or the others. And the thing that I remember Proclus doing is he multiplies the divinations. Of course, Gnostics have done this too. But this is, Neoplatonism is essentially not Gnostic. so instead of there to be just three before you get to the material world, there, I don't know how many, but it's multiples of three, if I remember correctly. now, if Proclus will himself go through the Christianizing filter, and the so-called, or one of his names is Dionysius the Areopagite, right around, if I remember this date correctly, around 500, thought, I think, to be Syrian, but probably writing in Greek, although the texts we have are in Greek. Of course, he's not really Dionysius the Areopagite. He purports to be, presents himself as this one success that St. Paul had in the Areopagite. in Athens, when he goes to preach, he says, whom you ignorantly worship, him I declare, and so forth. And they just laugh at him. Or they think he's crazy. And there's one guy, maybe you know this, Dionysius, who goes with him. Well, and of course, he got associated with this, theoretically, this guy, Dionysius, the way that this comes out in French, or Dennis, connected with the founder of the Abbey of what, St. Victor? No. The Abbey of, I'll come in a minute. And he's supposedly, after, being converted by St. Paul, ended up as a pastor himself, and he came to France. And where you got to the Basilica of the Sacred Heart, Montmartre, the mountain of the martyr. He was martyred there. That's a wonderful story. And his head was struck off, and well, he had said, I'm going to come to such and such place at such and such time. And they said, oh, no, you won't, because we've cut your head off. Well, by golly, he picked it up. And he walked with it there. Or something like that. Anyhow. So, this Dionysius was associated with this figure. Any case, medievals believe that this guy really was a disciple of St. Paul, and consequently that gave near canonical status to his writings. At any rate, but we know, because of the similarity of his thinking to Proclus, that, well, in one of these humanist kind of, textual, historical things, it could not be. And so he's sometimes called, you could call him St. Denis, if you want, you can call him Dionysius, or various people with pseudo in different places. So let's say pseudo, St. Denis the area, okay? Or sometimes they'll say Dionysius the pseudo Areopagite. Well, here's a picture. At any rate, very, very, very influential. I think more so ultimately in the West than in the East, amongst Christians. At various points, these guys' writings come in too. And there are many more hierarchies in this. And so you have this idea of the and so forth. And Dionysius writes about they're the earthly hierarchies and the angelic hierarchy. But then you should get beyond all of those. And one of the things that the angelic choirs, the different levels, are doing is helping you up. I suppose shedding grace down on you, or contemplative understanding, and so forth. Eventually, you get up to, as with Plotinus, you get up to this incomprehensible experience of God that is beyond all of our concepts. Not only do we have to go beyond the world that we know, enlivened by the soul or the individual souls. We have to get beyond the concepts of mind. Even the level of abstraction that you have with intellect is not sufficient for this. To really know or experience this one, you have to go beyond the crutch, the aids of everything we know from this world or from our inner experience. Okay, so, of course, this is one of those double-sided things because we've got Platonism all the way through. And at different times people get interested in, more interested in Dionysius. Augustine is present constantly all the way through, but even with him, there are times when people get, a renewed interest in him or influenced by him in a new way, or he has a new impact, a new force for them. But there are two things. What are the differences? The emphasis here is really on the unknowing of this getting beyond. Whereas with what's the emphasis with Augustine is more the tradition coming from him is the one that perhaps talks more about the wills, the meaning of wills, the meaning of love. And so maybe a little bit more tending towards the affective side of things, a will. Whereas this is more theoretical, contemplative, speculative, what they call speculative theology. Particular association influence the tradition of Dionysius the Areopagite. Okay, any rate, trouble at this point is there are people who feel like this who are definitely Renaissance humanists. Maybe like it too. But anyway, what's the last thing I have here? Too much of the line of wacky videos. In particular,
well, to a certain extent, I mean, the people who are sort of they're off the wall, but they're medieval. And somebody who might be, I don't know how much he's important, but John Scotus, Eriugena, 9th century, part of the Carolingian Renaissance, who was particularly an interpreter of Dionysius, and is an original thinker, and very, very Neoplatonic. But he's kind of weird and doesn't affect too many people in the later medieval tradition, at least of the Garo period, maybe. Then there is, and this is really closer to home, perhaps, Raymond Lullier Lull, Catalan, 13th century, if I remember correctly, who, in a way, like our hero, Nicholas, you know, Nicholas had more of a formal education than Lullier Lull. He's not like the general tradition of scholastic theology. He's not. He's his own thing. And Raymond Lull was also very much his own thing. And very much, he comes to be very much in favor of later Renaissance occultists. You know, he's all kinds of numerological stuff. And so we've learned from maybe Yates, Francis Yates, and so forth. Anyway, but they're wacky, but they're medieval wacky. And he's wacky, but he's medieval wacky too. All right, keep it safe. Okay, on the other side, how he is at least shed some light or shares something in common with other Renaissance humanists or Renaissance humanists is, we've said all about the optimism in things that human beings can achieve what they need to achieve in this world. A second thing is the fact that we sort of glanced on this, that he's interested in a lot of new things. He's very open-minded. He's particularly interested in scientific things, new scientific things. Now, there is a tradition of physical studies, sort of the nature of the world, structure of the world, and studying mathematics. He seems unusually interested in these things for a cleric and for a theologian and for a churchman, although there have been some churchmen who are great mathematicians. I was going to mention too, oh, I forgot, another one of these wacky medievals that might surprise you to hear it. Albert the Great, Albertus Magnus, 13th century, teacher of Thomas, he had some strange interests, along with his theological stuff that fit in with scholastic theology. He had some interests in the natural world that were a bit odd, and there's a tradition that he was, in fact, a magician. anyway, but going on. Nicholas is interested in all kinds of things, mathematical things. In fact, I find, now you may or may not have noticed it in this the text, if you read his other stuff, and you know, I recommend it, I didn't get very far in my mathematical education. I got as far as calculus, calculus 1, I suppose. The stuff right before that, the limits, and with that, it's something still with me. And what he's talking about is almost like the limits in a way. Although, of course, he talks about it beyond the wall, which is sort of not like a limit. But it is like, what is that term, asymptote? You're getting closer and closer and closer to something, but you're, you know, never quite there. But it's a further and further refinement, closer and closer approximation to something. And that's, I think of that as kind of a modern mathematical concept, physical concept. Even though I'm sure it's been around for a while, but he makes a lot of that sense of central image for him, a model. Okay, then what other interesting things? Okay, mathematical, physical.
I mentioned the fact that he put Marco Polo, and that's opening up to the rest of the world, if you like. He is interested in the East, both the Christian and the non-Christian East, although that's not an unevil thing either. He is interested in new approaches to ecclesiastical problems. I think they all have to do with, in a sense you could say, you could unify his whole oeuvre, his whole projet, as we say in French, his whole what his life is about. Reconciling unity and diversity. And so, one important thing is, you know, these councils, Council of Basel, in particular, is a question of what's the principle of authority by which we can ensure or affect the unity of the church? Is it the Pope or is it the council representing all of Christendom? And maybe it's not one or the other, but then what is exactly the relationship between the two? How do we play off one another and so forth? That was an issue for him for a long, long time. Now, theoretically, he started off, or what the usual understanding is, he started off as a supporter of conciliarism. Have you talked about this at all? You have talked about, I think, the Babylonian captivity, mm-hmm. better perhaps expressed as the French captivity, mm-hmm. and then after that, for a good number of years further, when the Pope decides to go back to Rome, then we end up with the Great Schism. And in the early days, I think in his early years growing up, the schism still existed, and it was an end was pushed to it just during his lifetime, when he was a young man. Well, he's very aware of that. And one of the things that came out of this is the conciliar movement, conciliarism, conciliarism, yes, which is this notion that the supreme authority in the church, meaning, of course, the Western Latin church, is not the Pope, but the council representing all of Christendom. And which sort of limped along in various forms until the First Vatican Council, you say. Although perhaps it has raised its head again since then. Anyway, conciliarism. He was more on the side of this, although in a nuanced way. And he was very attentive to historical considerations. What do we know about the tradition? What can we tell from these old texts and so forth? But apparently, as a result of his experience with what went on at the Council of Basel, he decided, oh, this is hopeless. So here, this is one of these cases that did he have experience of the concrete problems of unity and diversity. And at that point, he decided to throw in his, what do you throw in with somebody? Not his towel. Throw in his lot with the Pope. So he emphasized more of that side of it. And probably because of his youthful dalliance with conciliarism, as well as some other reasons, unfortunately, Nicholas will probably never be made a saint, proclaimed a saint. because people who, didn't take the Roman side, well, they don't end up saints, basically. Also, he doesn't have a spiritual family order that is promoting his cause. He certainly lobbies to become a saint. But this is certainly something that he's aware of, and the fact that the church at this time, he's just come out of this period of division, and there's always the possibility that it might fall back into it again. So he's interested in what can we do about this? So there's the question of authority, and then again another aspect of the question of unity and diversity is what do you do when there are disagreements? I mean, serious disagreements. And in particular, the so-called the problem with the Bohemians and the Hussites. And the Hussites, they're a sort of a proto
Reform, proto Protestant
movement, and what we for a while were trying to Czechoslovakia. But at any rate, but one of their there are some theological differences they had, but there is a ritual problem that they had as well, and the liturgy. They wanted to receive communion under both species, that is to say, the consecrated wine as well as the consecrated bread. Now, this had not been done in the West for a good while, except for the celebrant. It was brought back in with the reforms that took place after the Second Vatican Council last century, but for years, for decades, I mean for centuries. I don't know when it fell out of practice in the West, but it was sometime early, no doubt, for practical reasons, no doubt. But of course, it was kept in the East, and then for some reason, these fellows think they really. Well, it's partly the idea we're going to go back to what it says in the scripture and not, you know, what the ecclesiastical tradition says it's supposed to be. Well, he worked out, while he was at Basel, this idea of an agreement. I don't know that it was ever done with it, because Pope didn't like it. Okay, you guys can have a communion under both species. You accept these other things, you know, the authority of the church, the authority of the Pope, these other questions of authority and interpretation and so forth, and what's taught about the sacrament itself, I suppose. But you can have this. And they said, okay, that's what we want. That's good for us. So, so the question of diversity, it comes out in that area, and also, again, on the level of ritual, in his connection with the Council of Florence, Council of Ferrara, Florence, the Government of Ferrara, and he goes on to Florence, goes to Florence, I think because they ran out of money. And Florence at that time and the Pope were in real good terms. And so the rulers there said, bring them all down here, we'll take care of them, we'll pay for it. So, in the Wikipedia link that I give you somewhere about Constantinople and so forth, Ferrara, Florence, it actually treats these as all the same council, which is a little odd, although they do overlap, and there certainly is a connection between them, but they're usually thought of as two different councils. He ends up being involved in both of them. When this gets started, he moves over from Basel to this. These things go on for years.
It's not like, how long was the Second Vatican Council?
Was it even 2 years? 3 years?
Yeah.
Probably because communications were slower. It took longer to get things done, I suppose. While he was in Basel, he worked on this question of the Hussite problem. At Ferrara Florence, and before that actually too, he was working on this reconciliation, this attempted reconciliation between the Eastern Church and the Western Church. Now, you all know about this fact that there's a split between Eastern and Western Church for a variety of reasons, and there were all this complicated matter. There ended up being doctrinal disagreements, but there are also ritual disagreements. And one was whether or not you ought to put leaven in the Eucharistic bread. In the West, you didn't, on basis, I guess, of scriptural passages where they say throw out the leaven and so forth. And I think also when the Israelites are getting ready to leave Egypt, I think they eat unleavened bread, isn't that right? Because they didn't have time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Whereas there are other things where you say, well, precisely, you know, you put it in the leaven. And the leaven, which, you know, fills up the whole loaf, and so forth. So the West went one way, the East went the other way. Now, from our modern perspective, we say, well, you know, when it makes you feel good, very good. like you said to the Hussites. But for the medievals, this tended to be a lot of people. This is
answer his question. Other big ritual or calendar issue was when, or how do you interpret the rules for deciding on the date for Easter? And actually, not all of the Eastern communions have the same date, but and they tend to excommunicate each other, you know, on the, or they have on that basis. I don't know if they still do that. At any rate, there were these questions of very important questions, division, and there still are, in the Eastern Western Church. Of course, the most important one is the question of authority. Does it reside primarily in the Pope or not? And in a certain sense, this conciliarism is more in harmony, although it's a sort of a specifically Western thing. In certain ways, it's more in harmony with the Eastern approach than the Roman or the Ultramontane position. Okay. Anyway, my point here, I have a point. Oh, yes. In connection with this effort to bring East and West back together. Of course, the West wanted it. The Western Church always wanted it. Rome always wanted it. Because it's sort of like a gaping wound that is inside of Christendom. This very important part of the Church is, you know, reaching the home of the Church, close to it. Is not a union with Rome. On the other hand, the East, people in the East, in Byzantium, they were not particularly interested in it until things got really desperate. And there's the Turks, who are getting closer and closer and closer, and the Byzantine Empire is getting smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. And is almost down to nothing, almost not much more than the city itself by the early 15th century. And so they're saying, the emperor is saying, he's being pragmatic and saying, okay, we'll accept you. We'll say it's okay if you guys say filioque. You know, the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son, which was added, I believe, more or less in the Carolingian period in the West. Not accepted originally at Rome, but it took over in the West, and the disagreement. Oh, we'll say, you can say that, we don't have to say it. Well, at any rate, the point of this was the experience of this. This is another and very, very important experience showing Nicholas that there's a certain level which is these differences that seem so very important can be transcended. Must be transcendent. You must, even though they seem at variance, you must be able to shoot beyond them somehow to this what is it? Is the term asymptote? This place where there is some kind of unity. And eventually, and this I think of as certainly a new thing, a new modern age thing, if it isn't specifically Renaissance humanism, this idea of the world is a very diverse place. Let's let each other be on the matters that it's okay to let people be regarding. So long as we can see beyond that to the things that do unite us. So, okay. Well, that's my point about that. Okay. Another point in which he is humanist boy. We've mentioned this before. He does, even though he's not a great stylist himself, he did do that little service of bringing this manuscript to Plaus. I don't know if this manuscript was. I don't know if this was a discovery, a rediscovery of lost, hitherto unknown places, Plaus sites. I don't know. But anyway, he did that. More importantly, this is again while he's working in Basel, and he wrote a big long thing called on the harmony of the churches, or something about the harmony of the churches, Concordantia. Ecclesiarum, something like that. And part of that, he's doing, part of what he does in that is a historical and textual study of things, how to understand the structures of the church, what things have been historically, what foundation there is historically for certain positions that have been taken and so forth. Primarily on this, particularly regarding this question of the position of the Pope. And so, he himself, there's this famous document, which we now... It is generally conceded as a fake. But, you know, it's hard for us to accept. But maybe the
amount of abandon. Falsely attributing, you know, something you write to, you know, some other person that you're not. Anyway, this is the so-called text of the donation of Constantine. Constantine donation of Constantine. A document purporting to be by Constantine, so, you know, really the treaties, moving the capital of the empire to this new city over in the east. And as he goes, or some other occasion, I don't remember exactly what, he decides to, he's going to give over, it's not just certain lands, but as I recall, the text says something about, you have control over, well, the upshot of it is, he has control over all the west, the western part of the empire. And it's sort of his territory in a way. That's one of the aspects of this. Presumably this was a something invented during the more or less Carolingian period, when I was reading places in basic, to shore up the position of the Pope in the face of the increasing importance of the Frankish king, or eventually the Frankish emperor. In any case, it was by and large accepted as authentic, and became part of church law, and had certain consequences on Rome's understanding of itself, shall we say. All right. We finally get to 15th century. Who is the first person to write and say, or maybe some of the people who rejected it here and there in the past, but first person seriously critically look at the text on the basis of what he found in there and what is one known otherwise, history and of certain linguistic matters, like this expression they used in the century and so forth, decides it's not authentic. Who does this?
Lorenzo.
Arona, that's right. Everybody shout it out. There goes the concept. So this is what they're supposed to do. In other words, he predates Valla. Valla is going to do this, write a text on the donation of Constantine, which goes over the same ground, a little bit in more detail. And of course, he is a great authority on the Latin language, classical Latin, and then how different this text is from that, and so forth. So, Valla, we think he's one of the great Italianists, and particularly Valla, especially, is at the beginning of the historical critical movement, which is one of the great, perhaps the most important contribution of Renaissance humanism to our modern everything, modern view of just about everything. and he was ahead of him. Okay, what a guy. All right. Another point, we talked about this already. He is interested and aware of the diversity of the world. We said enough about this. As a non-humanist thing, I'd said he's connected to this line of wacky medieval thinkers, off the wall, but medieval nonetheless. But that cuts both ways, because if he's attached to them, he's also attached to other wacky Renaissance thinkers who follow in the same tradition, so to say. And in particular, this guy, Giordano Bruno. Heard of him? Poor fellow. He ended up he did have some strange ideas. In particular, he's associated with, or he's a representative, among other things, of the Renaissance interest in occult studies, secret doctrine, hermeticism, occult matters, and so forth. And among other things, well, what got him in trouble, one of the things that got him in trouble was some of his stranger notions
And one of the things that was objected to certainly was this idea that there are other worlds. That is to say, they're not so far from the Earth of being the only sun in the universe, but there are other stars. The other stars are like suns. And by golly, they might have planets. And those planets might have people living on them.
Was he the first to suggest that?
Do you think? No!
No?
Because who did it before him?
I don't know.
Nicholas of Cusa.
I don't know.
Pretty good at these, you know, abstruse texts. You know, that nobody. One of the problems, you know, later on with censorship, the suppression of people and ideas and so forth, the idea of censorship comes only after you have the printing press. Because that's going to happen very soon. But before that, you don't need to worry so much. These ideas are not going to be so easily propagated. Certainly not when they're expressed the way that our Nicholas expresses them. Whereas this guy, you know, he's a much better stylist. He's writing in Italian. and so, at any rate, he gets himself into more than just hot water. But here, one of these, and this is something that I don't have a passage for it, I'm afraid, but this is apparently Nicholas expresses this in a number of places. This idea of the Earth is not really the center, and the Earth is not really still. Of course, that has to do with the fact that he says everything is everything else. I don't know what he means by this. That's what he says, though. Everything is everything else. It's kind of just like Hegel. Or Leibniz, or somebody. everything, somehow or other, reflects it, everything else in the world. And as I say, I don't know what he means by that. But, among other things, is he's going to say that for the thing that encapsulates or enfolds motion is, in fact, rest. Just as the one enfolds. Encapsulate somewhere or other all number and all quantity. Don't worry about what this means. And so even in something that seems at rest, it's not simply at rest because the unfolding of rest is motion. But anyway, something about this somehow. Yes, he expresses what he exactly means by this, but the Earth is not necessarily. Still, as we think of it as being. Now, of course, this would be much more problematical when Galileo purportedly says, "E pur si muove," and yet it moves. But we haven't gotten to that point yet. Anyway, here's there again. Wow, what a guy! He was first on the scene with so many ideas. Okay. I had a point about his Neoplatonism. You have some Neoplatonism in spades with some of these Florentine guys. In particular, a little bit later in the century, you're going to have Piccino, Florentine, and Pico della Mirandola. That's all his last name, more or less, Mirandola. And his first name is, I forget what. Piccino in particular is very, very, and these later guys, they bring together all these different sources. They really know the Greek stuff. They know much before the Greek authors. And Piccino, oh my gosh, and is it ever, excessus et reditus, my gosh, I mean, going out from the one into the multiplicity of the world and bringing it back up again and so forth. Wow. Pico, of course, he's even more, he casts his net even more widely. But I think you could say that there's a big component of Neoplatonism, partly in the form of this wacky, I think of it, the kind of New Age for the, you know, like the second, third century, Hermeticism, the Hermetic tradition, which is sort of Neoplatonic, I guess. Anyway, so Neoplatonism, you can't deny his rights to being a humanist simply on that ground. Okay. Now, I would say there are two major humanist themes, in addition to all we said, two major humanist themes that I would say are elements, important aspects of Nicholas. And one is sort of a red herring in a way, but I'll give it to you anyway. Skepticism. golden word, skepticism. Have you discussed this at all yet, skepticism? For me, it's a sort of a golden thread, if you like, going through Renaissance humanism in different forms. We see it in Petrarch. Was not one of his texts on his own ignorance and that of others? This is something going back, of course, you see this, knew about this before the Renaissance, but this character who, according to Plato, what was his basis? How did he start off?
I don't know anything.
Yes, does it say, I know that I do not know?
Yeah.
Pardon? Sorry?
I know that I do not know.
I know that I do not know. This is, of course, as we will see, later lecture, we will see, this is a first level of skepticism. This is sort of easy skepticism. Or when they talk about the radical, talk about two theories of the fact that we're able to understand the universe, and one's a sort of an easy version, and one's a more radical version. At any rate, this is first stage skepticism we have here. I know that I do not know. And that's a starting point for a searching and inquiring and asking into the meanings of things or about the reality of things. And people knew about this, but it takes on a new importance here. Petrarch, you looked at this text, I think, on his own ignorance and that of others, or you saw a little spin of it. The reason you didn't look at the longer piece is because, it's very boring. But, in fact, you may already be willing to agree with me on this point that a lot of these Renaissance writers, they're boring. They're boring to read. And they're interesting for other reasons than the pleasure you get out of reading them. I think this is a sad but true thing. Not of all. Well, Petrarch, I won't go on that. Anyway, what he's saying is he's upset about Aristotelians at certain Italian universities that he's heard about. And of course, Aristotle has been a big name in theology since the end of the 12th century, certainly the 13th century. But there was a battle, particularly in the 13th century, over whether he was going to be allowed into the schools, into the teaching of theology, or if it would be permitted to comment on his works and so forth, and to use them in a big way in theological investigation. And of course, eventually, but not right away, there's a victory on the side of, say, Thomas Aquinas, of there is a way that, particularly, we can Christianize Aristotle sufficiently, or show that he can be understood in harmony with certain Christian teachings like the eternity world and the continued existence of the individual soul after life, the individual human soul after death. Anyway, but there were other lines of interpretation of Aristotle from the Middle Ages, particularly from the East, that is to say, from Islam. Islamic thinkers, and in particular, important ones in Spain, that were known in the West. And some people, even in Paris in the 13th century, preferred that interpretation of Aristotle. And what you seem to be having with Petrarch is a recurrence of that kind of thing, taking up a sort of a non-Christian interpretation of Aristotle, and of course, because he's a great Aristotle, accepting it as true. And he was very upset about this. Petrarch was very upset about this. Is partly maybe his ignorance of a profound theological, I guess he didn't know his Thomas very well, but he was saying, oh, let's go back to Father Augustine, let's go to Platonism. Plato seems to be a better guide for us, if we're Christians, than Aristotle. And that's one of the things that's going to happen to an issue throughout the this Renaissance. From a religious point of view, are you better embracing Plato or Aristotle? At any rate, he's saying, now,
these guys here are thinking themselves as really well educated, smart, and they are they might affect to be amazed at the ignorance of Petrarch regarding certain things. Gee, you don't know the teachings of Aristotle in this regard? You don't know this or that text or something? And so Petrarch responds to him. This is ironical. Say, on his own ignorance. No, it's true. Perhaps I don't know about that. But I know things that are much more important. You guys with your arrogance and your hyper-rationality, you think you've got it all figured out. Well, I, my humble acceptance of, the limits of reason and various other things, I'm in a much better situation than you are. I'm much closer to wisdom than you are. So this is a way of saying, okay, we don't like all this fancy, abstract, intellectual stuff. We prefer, you think that takes you up into the stratosphere and makes you kind of a god in your understanding of everything. We say it simply takes you away from reality. And we'd be better off if you said, I don't know, and I don't really care about these things up here, these abstract considerations. Because they're much more practical, urgent things that demand our attention. So, this is an idea of you guys, this is a reaction against a certain philosophical tradition, in a way, or maybe a philosophical tradition altogether, saying, you guys think you've got it, you've got the world by the tail, you think you've got, you understand everything. You think you've got the best knowledge of all, just in the truth. But, and so this is presented as a kind of a skepticism, saying, you think you know, but you don't know. You think you have a universal understanding, but this is made up stuff you can imagine. Whereas, as I say, with our this more humble approach, the more down-to-earth approach, more concrete one, we actually get further. Okay, well, that's kind of a first-level skepticism, and we'll find this reappearing at different times, and it's involved in this tussle, this argument. What are we going to emphasize, rhetoric or logic? What's going to be the basis for our understanding of our system of education, or the course of studies that we do? Is it going to be human-based? Is it going to be practical, concrete? That's going to be something airy-fairy, way up in the stratosphere, and so forth. And so this often presents it or itself, or it can present itself as a kind of a skepticism. Although it's a positive kind of skepticism, or being aggressive kind of attacking kind of skepticism. Now, eventually, we're going to get to towards the end, later on in the 16th century. Because of other things that have happened by that time, you have the second degree of skepticism expressed, well, by the guy we're going to talk about, Montaigne, and by some others in addition to that. The first degree of skepticism says, I don't know that I know. No, I know that I don't know, sorry. I don't know that I know. Okay, you got that? Mm-hmm. The second degree of skepticism, which is hardcore skepticism, says, I don't know that I don't know. So, you may have the truth and you don't know it. any rate, okay, that's just looking ahead a little bit. Now, he's a forerunner. He's the first one, almost, to do this kind of thing. And what am I going to say? It begins with G. Tolerance, specifically religious tolerance. The various commentators say about this text, it is astonishingly ironic. Astonishingly ironic, is that how we say this word? Ironic? Ironic? Peaceful. Peace. Not simply the fact that there's respect for these other people, because you can always, take that on as a stand to persuade people of your point of view. But the fact that at the end of it, he seems to say, well, okay, if there are problems, and if people don't accept it, of course, he's gone through the experience of
you had a communion, theoretically, at the top between the Eastern and Western churches.
It was rejected by the rank and file, as well as by some other people at the top, when the Easterners got back to the empire.
No, reject this. In the Eastern way, you know, they refused to go to church at Hagia Sophia, because it was the emperor's church.
You know, he was excommunicated as far as they were concerned. So he has had experience of these things not working out.
Nevertheless, at the end of it, so he says, okay, well, we still may have problems. Okay, we come to this sort of a theoretical understanding. We're all basically on the same wavelength. We all basically
believe the same things. But you know, we still may have trouble convincing our people. You know, these are rather abstract, rather difficult things for them to understand. And for instance, they may not accept the idea of communion. So he's saying, okay, just let them go, just let them do what they want. They don't care about that. After all, strictly speaking, receiving the sacrament of the altar is not necessary for salvation.
Well,
okay. Well, yes, you could say, you could imagine circumstances in which a person,
by circumstances, isn't able to go to church for a long time, in prison or whatever it would be on a desert island. And then if the person, you know, keeps up his some kind of religious practice or attention to divine matters, okay, that's okay. But for huge populations to go, for huge parts of the world to go without communion, you know, for a long time,
that's another step. So this idea of it, things can go on as they are. That's what he seems to be saying. Again, this is way up on earth.
It's pretty darn amazing. It's amazing.
And there was some tradition, not tradition, I'd say, but occasionally people in the Middle Ages would bring up the question, what do you do about the good pagan? You know, who lives apparently a moral life. And does this person go to hell? Because this person wasn't baptized. And it's acceptance and from the time of Augustine, you've got to have baptism in to be saved.
Well,
and in fact, that's kind of in scripture too. There are some people who'd say, I mean, at the limit, yes, say a Thomas would say, yes, such a person, there could be a person who, at a certain critical moment, like the age of reason, some moral choice presented with him, he makes a choice for moral law. And that would be sufficient, assuming that the person continued along that line, I suppose. In circumstances where there's no contact with Christianity, which they occasionally were able to imagine, and so forth. Now, but there is no notion that this was widespread at all. Since the tradition from Augustine, the understanding of Augustine was, the number of the saved was, you know, in the minority. Perhaps a very small minority. And therefore, yes, so are most of a whole people Christian, you know, are they going to be lost? Well, you know. That's how Christianity, that's how humanity is, basically. That's our situation. At any rate, this notion, or the idea that is expressed here, is very, very similar to the approach taken by modern theologians, and I'm thinking particularly in the 20th century, and Catholic, perhaps other too, certainly some Catholic ones, dealing with the problem, as one must, of the salvation of the unbaptized in general, of the Christian, and so forth. And what they do, say what a Karl Rahner does, but also, heck, I mean, they all do it. I mean, Urs von Balthasar, they will say essentially what he says, which is, there is a dynamism. How do you deal with the fact that Christianity seems a singular thing, historically limited, and so forth? Nevertheless, it has universal pretensions. It has a universal mission unfulfilled so far, and so forth. How do you relate that? And human nature and its needs and its goals, and then this thing coming from revelation and so forth that is above it. And so the answer to this is to say that in these other religions, or let's say Christianity in general, there is a kind of a correspondence to, or it is the true fulfillment of human aspirations. But not always recognized, not always known. And in fact, other religious traditions have a dynamism in them, inherent in them, insofar as they are authentic religious traditions, towards Christianity. And that in some sense, sort of the fulfillment of it is in Christianity. Now, again, he's the first one. Or you could say maybe Augustine, the martyr, said something like that. But no, this is, he's the first. In certain regards, influential, very influential for modern theologians. Indeed, I was for a long time very enamored of Hans Urs von Balthasar, 20th century theologian. And when I finally came around to reading Nicholas somewhat seriously, I realized he's straight out of Nicholas. His style is Nicholas's style. It was, well, quite a revelation. Okay, well, let's take a break, shall we? As there is this kind of a rapprochement between eastern and western parts of the empire. Oh, and you know the best reason why there shouldn't have been a rapprochement? I mean, what the Easterners have really to be sore about? Not disagreements about who was in charge, or even things like Filioque. The real issue, I mean, the really, really bad memory was the Fourth Crusade, 1204, in which the Venetians and some associates end up trashing Constantinople, taking over Constantinople and, you know, killing a lot of people inside, and setting up the Latin kingdom of the East. Not just in the crusading lands where they were previously, but in the center of Eastern Christianity itself. So it was the Latin kingdom of, what do they call it exactly? Latin kingdom of something. And eventually the Byzantinians themselves get back in control, but it takes a while, and it is arguable that the Constantinople would not have collapsed at the very end if the empire were not in such. It was in the weakened state that it was, above all because of the this period of the Latin Empire of the East. So when it was rather pitiful, I think, in this period before the fall, where the Eastern Emperor, he comes to the West, he comes to Europe, begging people to help him out, going to different kings and princes, and of course to the Pope. Of course, the Pope says, sure, we'll help you out, if you sign on the dotted line and do certain things, and so forth. Okay, so, any rate, yes, well, they weren't able to get quite the forces that they needed, at any rate, and so down it went. Now, you know that the fall of Constantinople is probably significant, partly for the influx of a lot of Greek Byzantine scholars fleeing to the West and setting up shop eventually in the West. There had already been a certain movement of that sort, and people already at the end of the 14th century already, people who are interested in learning Greek and having teachers come from the East, from the Byzantine Empire, to teach them Greek, this in Florence in particular. Well, as while these negotiations are going on for the rapprochement, for the reunion of the Eastern and Western parts of the Church, there's a lot more interaction between scholars on one side and on the other, and interest in exchange of ideas, but also of manuscripts, of texts, and so forth. And again, of this coming into contact with this, you could say, continuous tradition of knowledge of classical Greek texts, as well as of patristic ones. So it was, in a sense, it gave a further impetus to the Italian Renaissance with the fall of Constantinople. It was to their advantage in a way, although basically it was thought of in all parts of Christendom as a terrible, terrible thing. and very regrettable. One of the links that I've given you there, there's something about a, it's a tradition. I think it's Constantine the 11th or somebody, Heliologus, who was emperor at the time. And there's a tradition that he didn't die, but he was transformed supernaturally into a marble statue. And then someday you will be changed back to a living person. You know, when Constantinople is once again in Christian hands or something of that sort. Okay. Anyway, this CD has very, very interesting texts, Byzantine liturgical texts with music more of this period, and then also things indicating an exchange between Eastern and Western liturgical musicians. And you have, for instance, as was happening at that time, there are some Byzantine theologians, for instance, who are, say, from the 14th century on, are starting at last to start paying some more attention to developments in Western theology. And in particular, there's some people who are quite excited about Thomas, and rather amazed that Thomas, look at Thomas, he's taking our own tradition, well, you know, a Greek philosopher, Aristotle, look what he's done with him, and we don't do anything with Aristotle. So there is really, really interesting cross-fertilization that was going on, and then here in musical matters as well. Anyway, here, this is a Greek text after the fall of Constantinople, and it's a lament. We might listen to a little bit. I'm going to make this much, much bigger so you can see it. And this is number 16. Well, I need to make this maybe 500.
Name of the CD.
Want to be able to see? Oh, well, not the Greek part, unless you read Greek. Don't read it that well. And where is 16? Is that 16 down there? Well, it says the usual sort of thing, as you might expect. Okay, so that's a big prize. Anyway, so let's listen to some of this. Okay, now let me get this in here. What are we doing here? We need lament. I think it's this one here. Are we hearing this? Oops. We'll just do a little. I think you'll get the impression of sad. A kind of scriptural ring to this language. Oh, yes, I should say. It's a song. Okay. Well, possibly that's enough of that. Although, actually, I think the music in this is quite wonderful, and I recommend it to you. Anyhow, this other one here, there's a number of pieces here by Guillaume Dufay, who was sort of a Flemish, Franco-Flemish composer, early polyphonist. And one of the things that the Byzantines were baffled by, I think, was some of the contrapuntal stuff that was being done by the Western composers already. It's my belief, unless I'm, and I may be wrong about this, but I actually have this impression that with all due aversion for Westocentrism, Occidocentrism, and so forth, which I'm happy to abjure that, there are some things the West has done particularly well at, and I believe, if I'm not mistaken. Of course, there may be other planets where people, you know, there have been great developments of this like sort. But there are certain aspects of music that the West has done or has explored more fully than other people. I suppose the reverse could be true as well. But in particular, I should think harmony and counterpoint. That needs to be two of the four basic aspects of music, or so I've been told. And not that harmony, they must have known about harmony in antiquity because they talk about chords. I mean Pythagoras talked about that. But I don't know that they ever understood this as a basis for music or a basis for composition, the way that the Western composers eventually understood it. And so I don't know, obviously, yeah, everybody has to know something about harmony, but is there any other tradition where counterpoint becomes to be so important as it does in the West? And these things start essentially, the counterpoint business in the Hermit too, in the Middle Ages, especially in our high Middle Ages. And you have this counterpoint and polyphony kind of stuff with things usually going on in different, sometimes at different rates, but different lines of music that are, well, they have to harmonize, and yet they're not starting at the same points and so forth. And it's not just, I mean, a real simple kind of counterpoint is, or harmony rather, is when you just take an interval, and you'll have two different voices, you know, singing a melody and going up and down exactly the same way at that interval. Well, that's not much. Anyway, they're doing much, much more, getting very, very experimental in the 13th, 14th centuries. And they have a counterpoint that it sounds very bizarre to our ears, mine. Eventually get up to the 16th century where they develop certain notions of what notes go with what other notes. And it gets real sweet, almost cloyingly so, and so forth. But anyway, they're doing this kind of thing. And Juffé is an important figure in this. And so he has one too. And apparently he was involved, he was at this Council of Ferrara, Florence, and may well have composed some of the pieces we have from him in connection with that. This is another lament, and we'll look at his text too. Let's listen to a little bit of this. Wait a minute. Oh, that's right. How was he doing this? Weird, isn't it? Oh, they did the weirdest things with this medieval polyphony. They have different texts, different times, and the same different texts. He wasn't in my assembly. Different texts. And then other texts, four texts, in French. Ah! So, this one will have a father's son, and then they come over. Okay, and then what do we got? And then start with me. And, okay, I think this is what we're looking at. I think we're looking at right now. You got these different voices singing different things. And, oh, I don't know. I don't know what all is going on here. I really don't. You get you. It's not bad. At any rate, the passing of Byzantium, big moment. Interestingly, I teach every so often. I teach a course in the works of Professor Tolkien, and of course his. You can see a certain anti-Eastern bias, anti-Middle Eastern bias, if you wanted to, in Tolkien, and that his Gondor could be said to be modeled on Byzantium. You know, it's the one thing protecting the West from the hordes, the evil hordes coming from the East. And that's what it was. And in fact, this was, practically, the fall of Constantinople did spell trouble for Europe later on, and it is probably true that because that position was taken, it was only easier for the Turkish Empire to move into the Balkans, into to go as far as, I mean, they get as far as Vienna eventually, but that probably perhaps would not have been possible but for the fall of Constantinople. Okay, other things. There are a couple of texts I'd like you to be acquainted with in addition to this one. As I said on a previous occasion, one of the reasons why I have, for this purpose, I have people in Renaissance world read this text of Nicholas is, well, it's many connections with other things going on at that period. But also because it's sort of like Nicholas Light. It's not in particular. His texts are difficult. It's okay if you like that kind of thing, but it's kind of like, you know, liking a text on math, or some kinds of philosophy that are where, as I say, I do believe it is true that with certain kinds of mathematics, with physics, modern physics, subatomic physics, and philosophy, various kinds of philosophy, one is required to, I think of it as putting one's mind in an unusual shape, twisting it or stretching it into an unusual shape. And it's rather like some kind of athletics, where, you know, you go into it really big time, you develop certain skills that become habitual of, you know, hitting a tennis ball or whatever it might be, that are most unusual, that are unlike what most people are able to do. And similarly, I think there are certain mental habits that certain people train themselves into, where, and after years, certain ways of thinking, certain ways of looking at the world come to seem more natural, but it's not natural for most people. And in fact, with some of these texts, since I don't do this habitually, I can, while striving and stretching and straining, I can say, oh yeah, I think I almost see what he's talking about. And I might be there a little bit, but it's like the experience of, you know, union with God. You know, I fall back again soon, and I forget. What was that now, and so forth. So that's the experience of it for me. Anyway, this is still a much easier text than many another. And the worst of all, I think, is On Learned Ignorance, which is written in it's almost an atrocious style. Nevertheless, it's worth reading. And I wanted to have us look at a couple of passages from it, at any rate, which I think I've put up now, at any rate, well, I have here that I can show on the board. Incidentally, like this. Oh, St. Paul. St. Paul, that he kind of makes a reference to, you know, at the beginning of this text, where he says, you know, there's this guy who, after these terrible things that were happening to the Jews, and we heard about, he went to bed and he had a vision. And in his vision, at some point it's a little bit confusing. It happens at one place and then they're taken up to another level, and I don't know exactly what that means. At any rate, this is a fairly clear allusion to St. Paul, who, in his ride to Damascus, which is presumably what's referred to in, what is it, 1 Corinthians? Where does he talk about this? I knew a man who was taken up into the third heaven, whether in the body or out of the body, I don't know. This is one of these times when he's defending himself as an apostle. And so he says, I knew a man. It's him. At any rate, and so we can imagine that the author of this is talking about himself, whether we imagine that to be Nicholas or somebody fictional, but he's saying, yes, this is a vision that I had. Well, also like St. Paul, who had his vision, and this is presumably his encounter with Christ, and also, at least in part, the explanation of this experience explains his theological profundities that he expresses in his various letters. Similarly, our hero had his experience, and apparently this was one of the times he was sent over. This is before the Council of Florence, I think. He was sent over as a papal envoy to Constantinople. And on his way back, oh, this may be when he was bringing back, like, I think he's coming back with the emperor and the patriarch and other important people. And they're on the boat back to Italy, I guess. Has some kind of experience. And the result of that is this text and separate and various other texts. Any case, so we can look at it, so I can just give you a flavor of what is the really hardcore Nicholas is like. And before doing that, I'd like to read to you one passage from Dionysius the Areopagite. This is in his mystical theology. There are four texts that we think of as being by this pseudo-Dionysius guy. The mystical theology is the highest one. You always talk about the terrestrial hierarchies, celestial hierarchies, and the ecclesiastical hierarchies. I think that's what it is. And then there's the names of God, the mystical names, and it's sort of going up higher and higher. So ecclesiastical, and then there's a celestial, just angels. And then the names of God, different aspects of God, but using images to do that. And then finally we get to the mystical, which is the hidden, the mysterious, the unknown. And that's kind of the end point of all of this. Anyway, he has been taking us up and up and up and up and up through the levels. And finally we get to this chapter 5. I don't know what comes after that. Once more, ascending yet higher, we maintain that it, and he's talking about this God, is not soul or mind, or endowed with the faculty of imagination, conjecture, reason, or understanding. Nor is it any active reason or understanding. Nor can it be described by the reason or perceived by the understanding, since it is not number or order or greatness or littleness or equality or inequality. And since it is not immovable nor in motion or at rest, and has no power and is not power or light, and does not live and is not life, nor is it personal essence or eternity or time, nor can it be grasped by the understanding, since it is not knowledge or truth, nor is it kingship or wisdom, nor is it one, nor is it unity, nor is it Godhead or goodness, nor is it a spirit, as we understand the term, since it is not sonship or fatherhood, nor is it any other thing such as we or any other being can have knowledge of, nor does it belong to the category of non-existence or to that of existence, nor do existent beings know it as it actually is, nor does it know them as they actually are. Oh my God. Nor can the reason attain to it to name it or to know it. Nor is it darkness, or is it light, or error, or truth. Nor can any affirmation or negation apply to it. For while applying affirmations or negations to those orders of being that come next to it, we apply not unto it either affirmation or negation, inasmuch as it transcends all affirmation by being the perfect and unique cause of all things, and transcends all negation by the preeminence of its simple and absolute nature, free from every limitation and beyond them all. Okay, so, as I say, this is a classic, locus classicus of speculative mysticism, and it is a tradition that comes down in Western Christianity, although it's not always one of the strongest ones. But you can see that the style or the method is very much like what Nicholas does. Nicholas has been profoundly influenced by this. He says, yes, it's not this, it's not this. It's not is, and it's not not is. Because it goes beyond that. And it's not actuality, and it's not possibility. It's beyond that. And of course, the famous term of his, which is comes someplace in On Murder of Ignorance, is, well, you can write this down, the coincidence of opposites. The coincidence of opposites. I think of this phrase that Flannery O'Connor borrowed for a collection of her short stories. And this phrase she took, in fact, from a translation she had of Théâtre de Chardin, a 20th century religious thinker of ill repute in some circles. And the phrase is, everything that rises must converge. And that's sort of the idea of Dionysius, is to go up and up and up and up and up and up. You're divesting yourself of different things, but in a certain sense, you're also taking the world up with you. And all of these diverse things that seem so opposed and so unequal to each other in the world as we know it, as you go higher and higher up, you finally get to the convergence of them all, and that is in God. Actually, to speak of the tradition of Neoplatonism in the Middle Ages, what is really a classic text of Neoplatonism is Dante. It's all excessus and retitus, going out and coming back in to the one point. And who else? And even in someone like Thomas, who we think of as so Aristotelian, and not in the Platonic line so much, the whole structure of his thought, that is to say, of the Summa, which is based on, is a tradition itself, is a Neoplatonic one. The idea of there's the one
And then there's this sort of emanation outwards into the multiplicity of this world. And then in a certain sense, somehow or other, it's got to gather back in. And so that is the movement, if you like, of the Summa Theologiae and other similar texts. And so, in spite of all the Aristotelian elements that you have in Thomas, it is nevertheless, you can say that the basic structure of this theological thinking is a Neoplatonic one rather than an Aristotelian one. Any case, all right. So, in a certain sense, you could say, oh, this is Dionysius over again, but he uses it in so many different ways, or he uses it so constantly, and he does develop certain concepts. And you might as well be familiar with these terms. Like, absolute maximum. absolute maximum, this is not valley talk or something like that. It's the absolute maximum, which is God. Beyond which, and there's an important element of Anselm of Canterbury in this too, Anselm of Beck, and his 11th century work, right at the end of the 11th century, this notion that God is that thing in which nothing greater can be thought. So whatever, however big our thoughts can manage to be, he's more than that. He's always beyond whatever we can conceive. And again, that's something that is kind of an approach that in many, many different ways Nicholas uses. Okay. Anyway, the absolute maximum coincides with the absolute minimum. Mm-hmm. And of course, that makes sense if you think that, well, God isn't like, the vaporous thing spread out. You could think of it as a tiny little point. And this familiar phrase from the Middle Ages, God is a circle whose center is everywhere and his circumference is nowhere. Well, it's a very Cusanian, Nicholas kind of expression, although it predates him. Okay, absolute maximum coincides with absolute minimum. And then these other forms, the other terms, which are infolding and unfolding. Okay, like I was saying, all number, all quantity is inherent or exists in potency, it's not for a term for it, but in the one. And this, when we have this excessus that's going out from the one, that's when you see number and quantity and diversity and so forth manifesting itself. But in fact, in its infolded state, when it's taken back up into or seen in or understood or experienced in or whatever, in the one, in the absolute maximum, then it is. We see that it is one. And so we see, among other things, he uses all these mathematical examples. We see that all numbers, like 2 and 3 and 4 and so forth, actually all have to come from one, this thing. So, in a certain sense, infinity or infinite expanse is actually also this infinitely tiny point. You might think again of Dante with his picture of the universe, which is, you go these circles, these spheres, and these spheres, it's larger and larger and larger, and then the outside, the empire on the outside of the last shell, then you find heaven somewhere out there, and around that is God, or God's up above like a sun. But in fact, this is wrong, because another way to look at it is you turn the universe inside out, and the earth is at the very outside, so it's kind of exploded or turned inside out. And God is at the inner circle of he's the center of all these circles, rather than the outside. Okay, so absolute maximum. Okay, and I was talking about infolding. Every figure, everything that we think of is different. Like different people or different species. Different kinds of objects. They all end up enfolded in this one thing, or they in fact are there, they were there. And in a certain sense, the existence that any one thing we see in the world includes human beings. Its truest existence in a certain sense, or its asymptote anyway, is in fact God. And in fact he says that
God exists in each thing we see in the world in a contracted way. This is another term that we do. We have absolute, maximum, the absolute in God. And then we have certain characteristics of God contracted in the world as we know it. I don't know what the Latin is for that particular term. He is the fullness, and then this other thing, there's sort of a cut down version. And he actually says at one point in this text on the Word of Ignorance that there's a sense in which individual existence in the world, T of TS, are failed gods in the sense that we're a very contracted form of God. Now, what else does he say about this? It's the infolding and the unfolding. And incidentally, the words that he uses for this, the Latin words, are very funny. Complicatio is what is usually translated in English as, a very nice English word, infolding. And this makes sense because pico is Latin word, pico picar is fold. Com is with, or is with and together, or is an intensifier. And so he's using it to mean that you're going wrong. So what do you do with tiny thing? Now, of course, we think of complication as making things more diverse and varied. And divided up, that's because you think of folding, you do the, I suppose, if you fold this paper, you end up with all these pieces, a bunch of pieces, and some of them, all these other divisions. But he's thinking, it's all folding, it's kind of a spot. Okay, complicatio. And so that's the infolding. And then there's explicatio, which is the unfolding. And that is, that's sort of, and these are not things that are temporal necessarily, chronological, but they are, everything exists enfolded in God now. We're always does. And we have it out here, this is. And one of the things, of course, one manifestation aspect of explicatio is time, succession of time, which is the explicatio of eternity. Whereas, see, eternity is the infolded form of time. Just as all number and variation and quantity, bigger and smaller, comes from the one, so time comes from eternity and so forth, and various many other aspects. Okay, well, I recommend this to you to look at some passages at some point when you can of this text. It is. The first book has to do with more or less God himself. Oh, Trinity. And he works out how, oh, fine. Yes, God is beyond unity and diversity. He's beyond that. He's beyond singular and plural. He's beyond that. He's, again, these coincidences of opposites. Now, first book deals with the nature of God. Second book deals with the nature of the universe. Oh, and that has some wild parts to it. But the universe is, God is absolute maximum. The universe as a whole is a contracted maximum. No one needs that. Whereas individual smaller things within the universe are, they're not maximums in any sense. But there's a difference between absolute maximum, which is God, and contracted maximum, which is the universe. Anyway, the third then deals with the incarnation, which again is a coincidence of opposites, things that can't go together, and yet in some asymptotic point they do. And of course you see all kinds of these things. These are things that are used in various ways in the dialogue that you have read of the nature of God, and then particularly the Jesus Christ, and how it is that we conceive of this sort of thing, and then eventually get to the point in the argument where it says, well, this is in fact, we have to presuppose this kind of thing to make sense of any of our religions. Okay, now this is the most abstruse of his texts, perhaps, at any rate, of those that I know. But another text that he wrote about the same time, in fact, I think it's the same year, as this vision of the peace of the faith. He has a thing called the vision of God, the Visione Dei, which is, I think, a beautiful text, although it's partly very difficult, but beautiful, beautiful. And I think it's very fine work of spirituality. He starts off with, as he often does, he starts off with an image, a comparison. And what he does here is he talks about these pictures that were popular in his day. I meant to get a, see if I could find something like that on the internet, but I wasn't able to. Didn't have time. They're the face of Jesus, or the holy face. And there's these images that were popular at this time. And that we occasionally, I think, I seem to recall, they still existed in the forms of Catholic piety in my youth. You picture the face of Jesus. It may be during the Passion or maybe after the Resurrection, I don't know why. At any rate, this like close shot of his face. And the eyes seem to follow you. And, oh my gosh. So, you know, walk across the room. And so on and so forth. And so he uses this as a basis for a beautiful series of meditations on the nature of God and his relationship with each one of us. And it is true, he says, that, well, I mean, part of what he talks about here is the unicity of God, and how in God there are no divisions. He really, really means this. Nicholas does. He says, each of you, his being is his will, and that is the same as his action, and that is the same as his creation, and that is the same as everything is the same. And so, there's a certain sense in which his love of us is our love of him. And his gaze follows us around wherever we go. And each person, no matter where situated, whether moving or at rest, it seems that God is concentrating on him or her. And okay, this is part of what he has to say. Another part of it is that the holy face, the face of Jesus, is the infolding of all faces. And that if you take any human face, any individual human, is, well, the asymptote, using this term correctly, even in a metaphorical way, is the, how to say it, the maximum implied in this individual face is the face of Jesus. And the reverse of this is true also, that is to say, that Jesus is present, his face is present in a contracted form in each individual face. There's something about this I find very, very beautiful and very heartening, and very much in keeping with a certain kind of humanist spirituality. That is to say, an attentiveness to individuality, particular circumstances, diversity. Here, with the emphasis on the idea that he does emphasize as a particular kind of Christian thinker he is, of the presence, activity of God in each one of these particular points, places, experiences, visages, and so forth. Anyway, so I recommend that text to you too. And there you are. Maybe that's enough. So we can call it enough if you're willing.